You're tuned in to the Kojo Nam, the show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. Later in the broadcast, we'll check in with WAMU reporter Michaela Lafrak. She's at the U.S. Capitol today following Montgomery County students who walked out of their schools to rally for gun control. They have been joined by others. Earlier this month, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan signed a bill that would allow a woman who becomes pregnant through rape to sue and terminate the parental rights of her rapist. Most states have such legislation. In Maryland, however, it took 9 attempts at a bill debated over a decade, leading many to wonder why it took so many years and so many tries to get it passed. Joining us now is Maryland Delegate Kathleen Dumais. She represents District 15 in Montgomery County. Kathleen Dumais, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Kathleen Dumais, you've been working on this issue for years. Can you clarify what version of your bill was ultimately signed into law and how it differs from previous versions?
Sure. Actually, the version that was signed into law is one that we have been working on since 2016. Although we initially introduced this concept in 2007. When we introduced it in 2007, we put it in all three sections of our code that deal with adoption, because that's really one of the, that was a group that came to me with a concern. Were adoption lawyers who said they would have women in their office that would say, I'm going to carry the child to term, I'd like to give the child up for adoption. And then when the lawyer would say, okay, we need to get the consent of the father, the woman would become very emotional and concerned because she would say, I had been raped and I don't want to negotiate with my attacker. The version that we started in 2015 just set out a new section in the code, described a process, a court process, to allow access to the courts for someone that wanted to terminate the parental rights of the other parent because the child was conceived in a non-consensual sexual act.
Can you explain the differences between what apparently stalled this bill for so many years, and that is the two evidence standards, and how and why they were the sticking point of this debate?
Sure. No one questioned that if there was a conviction for rape, that the parental right should be terminated. The issue that many members of the legislature, and particularly the two committees of jurisdiction, the Judicial Proceedings Committee in the Senate and my committee, the Judiciary in the House, struggled with allowing termination of parental rights in a civil proceeding when there was not a conviction for rape. And yet 43 other states and D.C. have some protection to prevent rape victims from facing their attackers over parental rights, and 20 of those states and D.C. allow 23 of the states allow you to make that request in a civil proceeding and prove the attack happened by what we call clear and convincing evidence. And that was very important based on the few rapes that are actually reported, and of the 7% of rapes that are prosecuted, only 3% result in a conviction. So we wanted to allow the courts in a civil proceeding for a woman who elected not to charge someone criminally to be able, and again, the number of pregnancies are very small in comparison to the number of rapes, but we needed to have this in place.
In case you're just joining us, we're talking with Kathleen Dumais. She's a Maryland delegate representing District 15 in Montgomery County. How does your bill, Delegate Dumais, change the previous status quo? Your bill now uses the standard of evidence that is clear and convincing evidence as opposed to beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the court standard, which
is
the
correct.
Criminal court standard.
The difference between the two standards, depending upon which legal scholar you speak to, beyond a reasonable doubt is considered 99.9%. Clear and convincing evidence, which is used actually in some criminal matters, but primarily in civil matters, is somewhere between 75 and 85%. It is the same standard we use to terminate parental rights in neglect cases or cases where the parent is abusing drugs. So the standard that we were requesting for termination of parental rights in the event of a rape is the exact same standard that is used in Maryland to terminate parental rights in all of the other, any other basis that the court may have to terminate parental rights.
Which brings this question. You have brought 9 versions of this bill to the legislature. When you first introduced it, did you think it would be this difficult to secure support from your fellow delegates?
Absolutely not. This made it seem to make perfect sense to me. We were really just trying to we weren't going to trying to establish a law that made the decision. We were trying to pass a law that set up a process. Without the passage of House Bill 1 and Senate Bill 2, there is no avenue other than to negotiate with the attacker and ask that they consent to the adoption, or if you have the child and elect to raise the child, to go through a custody and access process where the attacker can ask for visitation or ask for custody. So we just needed a process, and it's not a slam dunk. It means it's clear and convincing is a tough standard. And if you don't prove that the child was conceived as a result of rape and that it's in the best interest of the child to terminate the parental rights, then we go back into the standard family law process, which would be who has custody and who gets to see the child when.
Many states and the District of Columbia viewed and passed such legislation as just common sense. Why was this bill so controversial in Maryland?
It really was a matter of making sure that we had enough due process protections in place for both sides. Now, I do think it took too long. I do think that members of the committee that were often criminal defense lawyers were pushing back, you know, more than necessary. Throughout the 10 years, there were times I felt like the goalposts kept moving. One of the sticking points at some stage was there are times, and particularly, you know, with a rape, maybe you don't know who your attacker is. But before an adoption can proceed, or the termination of parental rights can proceed, you have to prove to the court that you provided notice to the other side. So in doing that, in any civil case, there is a process where you can serve by posting or publication, which means you put it in the newspaper. And we didn't want the woman's name listed. And that's what the Maryland rules provide. But it was like we had to go back and forth. And one year it's like we laid it out and it's like, well, no, you shouldn't do that. You should just list the rule. The next year we came back, listed the rule, and it's like, well, no, we can't do just the rule. We have to have the whole thing listed. So there were, in fairness, there were games played throughout the 10 years. But I'm just delighted that we now have it, that there are good due process protections. The respondent, one of the issues was, okay, it's a civil proceeding. The respondent, the alleged attacker, may want to testify. But if you testify in a civil proceeding, they can use it in the criminal proceeding, except for the provision in our bill that says you can't.
But Delegate Dume, every perception tends to be everything. Does the decade-long journey for this legislation, in your view, have any effect on public perception of the body you're working in right now, the Maryland legislature?
I don't think so. It's partly because these are important. There were important due process questions. Clearly, I thought we addressed them a long time ago. But yes, there. You know, the other part of the question that is very frustrating to me, has been frustrating for the 16 years I've been in office, there is this general perception in family law issues sometimes that women lie. I often see the same kind of perspective when I introduce domestic violence legislation. If I'm asking to include additional things in a definition of abuse for a domestic violence protective order, there is always pushback that, oh my goodness, there is such substantial relief that's available in a protective order, like I can kick somebody out of the home for a year. We're worried that this would be misused. And that was the underlying issue with HB 1 and Senate Bill 2, overwhelming concern that could this possibly be misused. And what we do in my committee and in the Senate the Judicial Proceedings Committee, is we balance victims' rights with due process. And that sometimes is a messy process, and it was on this bill.
Sexual assault is not something women must respond to alone. So in the wake of your last comments, what's your strategy for developing partners in male colleagues on topics that have previously been viewed and labeled as women's issues?
The Senate bill was sponsored by my senator, Brian Feldman. And the initial sponsor in the Senate was Jamie Raskin before he went off to Congress. And, you know, so I do develop good relationships, and I've seen a major change in sort of attitudes and perspectives in the 16 years I've been here. I think the General Assembly is a different place than it was 16 years ago. When I arrived, it was very male-dominated. That's not so much the case anymore. We do work better across gender, as well as across the aisle. We're not Capitol Hill, thank God. You know, we have our differences that can fall on partisan lines, but for the most part, you know, we're working on policy that's good for Maryland. And this one took longer than it should, but we got to the right place.
The bill's last defeat at the end of last year's legislative session in May was perhaps the most disappointing for you and for your supporters. It also sparked the most controversy, brought a great deal of attention, because the panel charged with hashing out the final version was made up entirely of men. Did that, in the end, you think, help pave the way for the bill's passage earlier this month?
It did. There is no question that it did. Now, I do have to admit that the men that were on the conference committee, that three of them were co-sponsors, and adamant support, and, you know, and it was cross-party. It was a bipartisan group. So I don't think that it, I don't want to blame those gentlemen because they were very supportive. We ran out of time, you know, and the conference committees weren't appointed until sine die, which is the last day. And I have to admit, sine die is kind of a crazy day. Several, you know, you can be mad at somebody about something completely unrelated, and funny things happen on sine die. That was the push to have this as an emergency bill this year, to get it completely done and not get caught up in the last week of the session when a lot of things are complicated, and I wouldn't say traded, but, you know, sometimes people are irritated with one or the other and then they don't do something else. So we got it done.
Here's a comment we got from Steve in D.C. that you've probably never heard before. Concerned that the legislation Dumais is discussing will allow women in custody cases to make one more false claim about the male parent, the system is skewed toward women. And you, Delegate Dumais, say?
It's not skewed towards women. And that is exactly a concern that was raised in both committees several times, that this is going to come up now in every single family law case. I have been practicing family law for 28 years. I represent men and I represent women. And I think that our courts are smart enough if they're, number one, it doesn't apply to people that were married. Unless there was a protective order in place at the time the child was conceived as a result of rape. So it's not going to come up in the cases where people were married. If there's a custody order in place and the, you know, both parents are seeing the child, someone all of a sudden say, oops, now I don't want him in my life, and so I'm going to claim rape. I think, if anything, there will be sanctions against the person that tries to play that game.
Well, on the other hand, we got a tweet from Shana who said, this bill seems like such a no-brainer. But, Delegate Dumais, we don't have a great deal of time left, and I'd like to move on to some other issues that will be considered in this legislative session. Maybe gun control. Last Wednesday, a shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, sparked yet another debate on the role of guns in America. The very next day in your legislative district, an 18-year-old student brought a loaded 9mm handgun to Montgomery County's Clarksburg High School. He was arrested. Multiple firearms were found in his home after a search. In response to these incidents, can you give us an idea what the thinking of the Maryland delegates right now might be on the appropriate response to school shootings? Can Marylanders expect any state action in terms of gun control?
There are several bills that we're looking at. One is part of the leadership package, which will ban bump stocks, although we actually describe it as any accessory that would allow a semi-automatic to become an automatic. And I imagine that I don't think there's going to be too much opposition to that. There's a bill that Delegate Geraldine Valentino Smith from Prince George's County has that will allow a family member or law enforcement to request a protective order if they believe someone who could be a danger to themselves or others has weapons and that the weapons should be removed. Now, that might be somewhat controversial because anytime we talk about removing weapons and, you know, mental health issues, but it is certainly something to discuss and, you know, something that the federal government hasn't been able to do. Keep in mind, Maryland has about some of the strongest gun laws in the country. You cannot buy an AR-15 after the passage of the Firearm Safety Act of 2013. I do understand that there was an AR-15 in the young man's home from Clarksburg, but the news reports so far are very clear that there's not been a determination of who owned the guns. Clearly someone in that house, but the ownership hasn't been indicated. There should never be a gun in school. And that's, you know, sort of something that we're going to have to, you know, address. And I don't have a good solution. I don't think the solution is we have a bill that says teachers should have guns. I don't personally believe that's the solution.
Allow me to interrupt before you go, sure, because there's one other piece of business that I'd like to get to and that I'd like you to hear.
Okay.
WAMU's Michaela Lefrak is at the U.S. Capitol, where students from Montgomery County have walked out of school today for a self-organized gun rally. They are joined by others. Michaela Lefrak, are you there?
I am. Hi, Kojo.
Hi, Michaela. What's the scene there right now?
Sure. So we marched from the U.S. Capitol all the way down the mall, up 15th Street, and now are congregated at the White House. Can't exactly estimate numbers, but there are kids as far as the eye can see, hundreds of students here, protesting and trying to make their voices heard for stronger gun control legislation.
Are students calling for anything specific, any specific kind of legislation?
Well, for one, these kids are really well-versed in these issues. I'm incredibly impressed and inspired by how well-read they are on these issues, on what happened in Florida and how it affects them and their schools. I talked to a number of kids who are very against arming teachers or more officials in their schools. They've talked about strengthening gun control laws around keeping people who have mental health issues away from guns, making it tougher for people in general to get guns. And a lot of kids have just talked about how crazy they think it is that people can get their hands on AR-15s and assault rifles like what was used in the Florida shooting.
How was this rally organized? Was it done with the knowledge of school administrators?
Sure. So from what I can tell, students in Montgomery County, specifically Montgomery Blair High School, put out the initial call for this rally, and it really took hold. There are students who heard about it on social media and who were showing up for the first hour or two, streaming off the Union Station Metro. Every kid that I talked to said that they were here with the full support of their parents. School officials have said that, you know, they can't officially condone the event. Some schools, like Blair High School's principal, said that she would meet with students at the school during lunchtime to talk about these issues rather than have them skip school. And they are being marked absent from school. But kids, I feel like they do feel like they have the support of their communities to be here.
Are there many students there?
There are many. I would say hundreds. Right now, they are filling up that lawn right in front of the White House. When we were walking down, people on the mall, people in buses were chanting and cheering for them. They went as far as I could see. I'm not very tall, but there were blocks and blocks of students. And they're 14 to 18 year olds. They're all different, races, genders, ages, and they all felt really united and excited to be here.
When you can't count them all, that's when we invoke the term gugobs, gugobs of students.
Exactly.
Michaela Lefrak, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Kojo.
Kathleen Dumais, is this a demonstration that you would support?
Absolutely. I have been so impressed with the students in Florida. And I think that this might make a difference. Maybe the members of Congress, and certainly the things we can do here in the state, will listen to the next generation that is really pointing out this is intolerable. It doesn't happen anyplace else but in the United States. We have to stop it. And maybe it's going to take that next generation to do it. Good for them in using their right to freedom of speech and right to assembly.
Kathleen Dumais is a Maryland delegate representing District 15 in Montgomery County. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nnamdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.